are you? And he said, not at all. It comforts me. And I just thought, wow, you know, good for him that that's enough. You know, like, I don't know what I think about death. I don't really have any ideas about it, but I love that he knew, and I love that it was enough for him.
That certainty.
That certainty and that sort of deep, deep, deep faith in the physical, real world he had, you know? He didn't need to stretch beyond that, and I love that, you know? He wasn't the reason I went to Sunday school, believe me. If it had been up to him, we would never have gone. That was totally my mom.
So I wanted to speak to what a later part of that same poem, because I think that you're helping us kind of go move to the next point. Later in the same poem, you say, please do not try to make it better. For now there is a hunger in my lips, in my hands, as if I've been called late to wander. And I found that part of the poem particularly haunting, with the very particular words of don't try, the idea of a hunger, being called left to wander, sort of the helplessness of loved ones who watch something happening to someone, like you were saying about your friend, and people who cannot change, the thing with no cure. It's as though the image that it's helped me with was that the person suffering is on their own. And the phrase left to wander, for some reason, I think because there's so much spirituality infused in it, was like to wander alone in the desert with what you have to live with.
Well, I mean, there isn't a moment yet, Avi, where I don't feel really understood by you. So thank you. And so I want to say that poem was written in part about both an external and internal struggle I was having with talking to my husband, who I'm really, really close to. And I feel like there is that funny line where you really want someone to tell you it's going to be okay, and then you cannot be reassured by it because it's not okay. And so I was having this whole conversation both internally and externally in the poem about it. And it does function for me as also my own conversation I had to have around what I wished I could do and say to my friend Gregory and my friend Mary, you know, like especially Gregory. There was never a chance for me to say goodbye to him. There was never a chance for me to say, you know, you were the best friend I ever had and probably ever will have. So there is a way you're wandering in those terrible moments of crisis. You are wandering. And I think the other thing I was trying to say too is I'm gonna have to learn to live in the world differently. And it's true, I don't even notice it now. I use my hands so much to get around. Touch has become such a important sense to me that I don't even know half the time that that's how I'm figuring out what's going on around me. And I was just beginning it then. And so it felt a bit like, you know, when you go outside in the dark and you're a kid and you're just sort of feeling your way around and it's really scary, but it's also kind of like you're learning a new language. So it is a bit of a wandering in the desert, but it's also late to wander in the sense of, wow, this is late in my life to have to relearn everything, you know? Although I'm gonna guess in some ways we all go through that. You know, none of us gets to escape illness and death. So I would imagine we all kind of are called late to wander. Hmm.
Well, I also, just to transition a little bit to another of the main themes in the books, is I do think one of the aspects of the book is that you explore through what we call now eco-poetics, sort of the degradation of the earth itself and feelings of melancholy and grief and rage at the loss of our ecosystems while you're sort of losing the visual information that's coming to you, which is so grounding and so obviously the center of your life is your experience with the physical world. Can you talk a bit about the experience of those two phenomena?
Wow, well, I never even thought to put those two together. You know, I think one of the things I've learned in going blind, or I wouldn't say I'm going blind, I would say I'm near blind, is that there are a lot of other senses to rely on that we don't even pay attention to. You know, I mean, you know, I know you know the difference between a proximal and a distal sense, right? And so, you know, vision is a distal sense. It's, we see things that are far away. Proximal are more like touch and smell and taste. And honestly, the degradation that is in the in my world is very proximal. When the forests are burning and you can't go outside because the air quality index is just terrible, no one needs to see it. You can taste it. You can breathe it. You can feel it. And the same with, you know, I live in a very hot part of California. I live in the Central Valley. And when it gets up to 120, I don't need to see it. I can feel it. You know, I recently wrote a poem after, because as the poet laureate, I am, my whole entire platform is around eco-poetics and poetry of the Anthropocene. And I was out on a ranch as a visitor, and I had been thinking so much about this poem I read by Chase Twitchell, where she's basically saying, the gist of the poem is, why do we talk about anything else? We are destroying our world. How can we talk about anything else? And I was thinking about that. That was a lot in my mind. And I was moving through this orchard, and it was an incredibly hot day, and it was so cool in comparison inside the orchard, but the ground was so dry. I could feel it cracking under my feet, and the leaves on the almond trees, it was an almond orchard, were so dry that they were sharp, like they would hurt you if you touched them. And these are all things that you don't really need vision. Now, I'll tell you what I do need vision for. So there was a bird I was listening to singing, and you know, I had to ask my companion, do you know what bird that is? Do you know what kind of birds are around here right now? Like, that's frustrating me. I can't see that. So in that way, I do lose information. But in a lot of ways, I don't know if I lose information, because really ultimately, when I got to the end of the orchard and suddenly I was looking out at this scorched valley, and the wind was so hot and it was pouring over us and our hair was flying in the wind, the experience of that in a way was, because it's proximal sense, it's more powerful in a way. So I don't know how to answer that, you know, entirely, other than to say I am learning new ways to wander.
Well, I think also it's a commentary, what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that it's a commentary on, it's a multi-sensory degradation of the physical world, and you feel it in all different ways in your body, and different sensory information is now being heightened when one is being put back. Yeah,
that's, and I,
part of what I'm hearing, but yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking about something the late poet Arthur Smith said to me once. He was the my angel mentor. He chose me for, I think he was the one who chose me for the Discovery Award. And when we got to read in the 92nd Street Y, he kind of basically said to me he would be there to help me. And I remember we had so many wonderful conversations, both in person and also, you know, online. And one of the things he said about my work was that it was very kinesthetic. And he said, do you think it's because you've always had terrible vision? And I had never thought about that. So I think it's more of a reliance on the other sense than I would ever want. But in a way, I've always been there. But it reminds me of something else I didn't say to your beginning question about this project. I really wanted to know too, the concept of spiritual vision versus the, you know, physical experience of perception and sight. You know, what was the relationship between those two things? I don't have an exact answer, but I do think a little bit what I'm saying to you is there is a bit of a spiritual wandering around in the dark that going blind just necessarily requires, right? Like, you don't have a choice. And when you can come through it with a sense of meaning and contact in the world, it does feel like you're developing vision much more than sight. And I'm not saying I would choose this. I wouldn't. I would love to have my vision back, every last bit of it. then I think about, you know, I miss it. I really, really miss it. But it there is something to be said for what are you going to make out of it rather than, and it gets back to that feeling I had with Gregory. Like, if you can't make something out of it, what are you left with?
I think that's a good way to pivot to the next theme that I think is present in your prior collections and in this one. Your other career has been working with abused and neglected children. That work is featured in your poetry often as well. Where do you place your experiences at work with the framework of grappling with God?
You know, that's such a huge question. And I guess I'd have to say, Avi, that my work with those kids made me understand that sometimes we are hurt so badly we don't survive. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of sitting around and trying to figure out how to make meaning. Sometimes we don't even get called to wander. Not even late, not even early. We're just not called to wander. We're destroyed. I do think that when you ask me if that's a religious dilemma for me, that's always at the heart of why I've ever written, is why is there so much beauty next to so much horror? Why is there so much violence next to so much kindness? Why are we given these gorgeous things? You know, like you look at an animal and you think, why is that bird? It's so beautiful, it makes no sense. And then, you know, here we are like pouring poison into rivers. Like, why? It doesn't make any sense. So yeah, that's always been why it's been hard for me to praise God in the traditional ways.
Well, that sort of leads me to my next question about, just to be a little bit more specific, you've alluded to your religious upbringing was Judaism. And it is another thing that I found in this particular collection, is the God that you're speaking to really reverberates as a, and I say this as another Jewish person, as an Old Testament sort of God of Judaism, which is one of sort of capricious, jealous silence that's still worshipped in a kind of a strange way. And it seems like you really engage in a dialogue with that Old Testament God. Did you feel like your particular religious background informed how you took on this questioning?
I don't know how it couldn't, because in a way, when you start as a little girl, you know, I mean, there is a level of indoctrination no matter what, right? And, you know, luckily some of us get to question it as we get older and say, what about that? What about that? And that's partly why I wanted to read other religious texts. You know, I felt like, oh, I better figure out a little bit more about other things that are being said.
One aspect of it I was wondering about was, we often talk about the silences between the words and the part and being part of a poem itself. Did you feel that connected to this idea of this sort of silent, unanswering God figure that you were wrestling with?
Well, I love that you're bringing that up, Avi, because there's silence is so important in poetry. I mean, it's so much a part of what poetry is, and compression and rhythm and image. So much of it has to do with silence and the music. So I love that you're bringing that up, the silent, unanswering God. And I have to say, I wish I had thought more consciously about that. It's a really fascinating question. You know, it's funny, I don't know that I ever thought about the fact that God didn't answer. And I think maybe it's because my daughter had told me around the time she asked me what I believed in God. She had told me one day she asked God a question and that God had answered, but God doesn't answer the way you think God answers. And that she had gone out to ask God something, and then all of a sudden there was a deer in the meadow, and she took that to be the answer. And she said, so the trick, Mom, is figuring out what it means. It's not that God doesn't answer, it's that you have to figure out what is being said. I guess the reason I've never thought about that is that's sort of what the poems are trying to do. They're trying to figure out what's being said.
Well, that reminds me of a question that might be a little bit off topic, but one of the things I was wondering about as I was reading all these poems was, is there a separation between you and the speaker in the poem, and the voice of the poem? And sort of what you had just said reminded me of that sort of question of like, is it you addressing your life, or is there a persona involved in it? And when you bring up sort of questions of how would God speak to us, it reminds me of my inquiry about the poems.
Well, I love that you're asking that, because I think that's a really important thing for people to remember. Poetry is fiction. It's not memoir. It's not nonfiction. It's fiction. And so you can invent whatever you want it. And there is a lot of invention in these poems. There's a lot of, you know, the poem about the October ER really actually wasn't about my friend Mary. I had another friend that had happened to, but it made more sense in the thread of the book for it to be Mary. It would be too confusing. I wasn't watching the elephants on a TV. I had seen that months before, but had been super moved by it. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that. And yes, there, I mean, when I write in God's voice, clearly that's not me. There are so many poems in there where I'm trying things on. I'm wandering. I'm not necessarily knowing. And I have to say, for me, I don't set out really to write a poem. The poem, if I'm working correctly, the poem will write through me. And so it always feels a little bit separate and deeply connected to me. And I don't know how to explain those two things. There's some tension in there between, if I just stuck to my own boring voice and my own boring obsessions over and over, nobody would want to read anything I wrote. Like, I wouldn't want to. So there has to be something that goes on that feels a little bit beyond me when I'm writing. And I love that you asked that question. No, it's not me, but it is.
Do you start with content or do you start with form? How do things tend to come to you?
I start with image, and I try really hard not to be in control. I try to let go. And when I get stuck or I feel like I'm being too predictable, I try to get up and move around and open a book and read a passage. Or, I mean, my whole process is to get outside of my own brain. I don't know how received it feels, although ultimately I'm always kind of, if it's a good poem, I'm kind of surprised, like, oh, I always think I'm never gonna write a decent poem again. I'm almost certain that was the last good thing I will ever write. And I know a lot of writers feel this way. So I'm always surprised when something happens, but to say receive feels a little passive to me. Like, I feel like I work really hard, and there are those incredibly talented people who don't work that hard, but I'm not one of them. I work so hard. I guess I feel like this, that the thing that most connects me to what he's saying about it being spiritual, which I really agree with, is the feeling that you have to be open to receive what the world is giving. Like, the world really does give us things every single freaking day. You know, yesterday I was outside and there was a man pushing his baby. He was an old man. He was clearly a grandfather, if not a great grandfather, pushing this very alert baby in a little baby carriage. And the baby was staring at him, and he was staring at the baby, and he was singing in the most tuneless way as he pushed this little carriage so slowly. And they were like just completely caught in this rapt moment of each other that was just astonishing to me. And I mean, that feels received. Like, I had nothing to do with that. You know, that was just there. And my goal at that moment is, can I pay attention? Can I take it in and not need to know what I'm gonna do with it? Not need to know where it's gonna end up. Like, that feels really important to me. Like, letting go of control feels really important to me. I mean, obviously there's all those other moments where you go back into a poem and you have to revise it, and you have to figure out how you're gonna control it, but certainly not in the initial process of writing it.
Well, it seems like part of what you're saying is that your effort is to protect the image as it is delivered into your senses and not let it be intellectualized.
Yeah, I think that's one way of saying it. I mean, I don't feel any, if something happens where I need to change it, like say I decided it had to be a woman for whatever reason pushing it, you know, like I wouldn't feel bad about that at all. Mm-hmm. If that's what it needed to be. But yeah, not to be intellectualized, not to, and also just not to miss it. Like if you're gonna receive things, you have to go out in the world open mm-hmm. to receiving, right? And there's a lot of painful things that will come in.
Well, getting back to the sort of, one of the themes that I was talking about is how that's a beautiful image for us to sort of move into the next question about how to take a tender image, the way that you put that beside a sort of violent or brutal image. And this is the next thing I was going to ask you about is in the poem that you wrote, I might not have the correct name, but about Ordinary Psalm After Another Mass Murder.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
Because one of the things I love about that poem is, again, this sort of mindless violence performed solely to create maximum damage. But the poem moves towards, after the turn, to this line. Listen, somewhere in America, a child pokes at a piano, tormenting melody, still convinced that with practice, beauty can be put back together again. That phrase, beauty can be put back together again. There's something about the transmutation of violence from the beginning of the poem into the hands of innocence that really, it's sort of an improbable impossibility. Somewhere, still convinced, can be. It's like the poem promises nothing, but it delivers that sort of delicacy of hope in that one small image.
Well, I love the way you say that, Avi, because that feels exactly what I was trying to do. I was also trying to talk too about the parallel between my own experience of being forced to play piano and the music that I would hear that I would find so beautiful and knowing I couldn't make it, you know? And then this terrible neighbor in the poem who's gonna burn our house down but plays this gorgeous music and says such sweet things to his dog, you know? I mean, it's sort of like, I think it's that feeling of knowing because of my work with the kids, because of my work with myself, because of growing up in a family with a very violent father who also really loved me. I think it's that knowledge that at any moment, you don't know what's gonna flip, right? You don't know where beauty turns into terror. You don't know where love turns into violence. And it doesn't mean that that particular perception of things is the only one, because there's many lovely, lovely, lovely people in this world that are not like that, mm-hmm. you know, that are much steadier. But I do think it wouldn't make his interesting writing, you know? the dramatic tension, the narrative wouldn't be quite as interesting there.
Well, I just wanted to ask that sort of, when you use the term beauty in another poem in the collection, you say beauty sometimes enters like a knife. So you bring this sort of danger and hopefulness within that kind of description. So I just wanted to ask about when you're bringing that word beauty, it seems like you're talking about a larger concept to swirl back to. Is it the sacred? Is it, you know, what is precious in this world? Or I just wanted to ask you a little bit to expand on that.
Well, I would say yes and yes. I'm really talking about, for me, mostly I feel it in the natural world, although I can really feel it in relationship to other people as well, and particularly to children. I feel this real affinity to children's, I mean, it's not that they're nice all the time, they're not, but when they are and their innocence and their capacity for love, it's interesting though that you bring that line up, because it reminds me of something. I did a little experiment with myself once. I was driving out to this place in the coast I love to go, the California coast, and there's one particular spot where when it's not the middle of summer and everything's not brown or burning, you look out and you see this amazing tableau of green, and it's all these hills and trees, and you see a long way, and then there's the ocean, and it's just stunningly beautiful. One day I decided to do an experiment of try to look at this beauty and not stop myself, like not turn away from it, or at least try to figure out what makes me turn away from it. And I realized actually it kind of hurts. Like the way it comes into me, it feels painful. It's so beautiful, it hurts. And it's like, what is that? Why? Like, what is it about beauty that hurts? And I mean, I could come up with all kinds of hypotheses, but I do think there's something about the nature of things that feel so perfectly, impossibly wonderful and gorgeous, and our own deep, deep knowledge of impermanence that creates pain.
Well, it's almost like you're describing the experience of awe has a kind of tinge of melancholy to it.
Yes.
Because of that sort of knowledge, or it brings with it that impermanence.
If yes. You're
really opening to it. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. There's always a sense of awe in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Julia Levine, it has been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, can I just say, Avi, you are a wonderful interviewer, and thank you so much for being such a wonderful reader of my work. I am really, really touched.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for listening to this week's Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host, Avi Marr, with musical help from John.
listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.